proceed.
Please support. My name is Tim McPhee. I represent the appellant and plaintiff below. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. My argument, I believe, may be brief today, and I would not want anyone to imply that I don't feel strongly about the positions that I have indicated in our brief. But I believe the issue for the court is not a particularly difficult one. We're here on a granting of a demurrer on a claim based upon a recent decision by this court in Wyatt with interfering with parental or custodial rights of the mother. What we believe to be the egregious nature of the respective defendants in this case is essentially found in the minutia of detail found in the statutory mechanisms in place for changing custody and going through the adoption process. I wanted to point out that this begins with actually criminal conduct that occurred at or from the birth. There is a penal statute that creates a class 1 misdemeanor for engaging and placing children for adoption if you're not either part of the Department of Social Services or a licensed child placement agency, and that statute is found 63.2-1712.
So you think that passing the name along to the potential adopted mother is acting as a placement service?
I think that participation by providing an adoptive parent, the name of a potential adoptive parent by the employees, is in violation of statute. Yes, I do. They are not permitted to be engaging in adoption process as was alleged in the complaint. What should have been done was if a mother came in that had indicated that they may be wanting to place the child up for adoption, they should have been referred to the Department of Social Services. The hospital employees should not be engaged in the placement of children for adoption.
Well, maybe not in terms of the policy and practices of the hospital, maybe, and maybe not in terms of whatever professional ethical codes apply, maybe, but you think it's a crime?
I did. 63.2-1712 creates a class 1 misdemeanor for individuals who engage in adoption placement if you're not part of a licensed placement agency.
Well, let me ask you this. This is not a criminal case. This is a Wyatt case. And in Wyatt, we adopted, over a fairly strong dissent, I might add, Section 700 of the Restatement Torts, which was the predicate for the Kessel case, the West Virginia case that we cited quite a bit. And in that doctrine, you have to allege as a plaintiff that the person you're suing had knowledge that the parent does not consent. So when I read through your most recent amended complaint, I tried to find a single sentence that said, I did not consent to the child being taken to the ICU unit at the nearby the Tennessee hospital. I never saw that.
Well, I don't think that particular allegation of fact is not present.
Okay, so therefore, the removal of the child for the period of the time the child was at the Tennessee hospital was not a factual violation of interference because there was no allegation that that was done without the consent of the mother. So that only leaves one other potential interference, and that is initiating a process towards a private adoption.
Well,
how did the hospital do that other than pass a name along? Or the doctor do that?
Well, I understand that Your Honor disagrees with my position, but my position is that they are not allowed to do that, and it's a violation of the law to do it.
And do and what?
To be engaged in this facilitating adoption in the hospital with one of their, if you will, co-workers, a nurse, the pediatrician.
Okay, so boil that down to more practical terms. Are you saying that when a doctor or a nurse or some hospital employee says to a birth mother, after the birth mother announces the intention to give the child up for adoption, are you saying that passing along a name to that person is a per se violation of this tort if you're not a child placement agency?
I think in the totality of these circumstances, what occurred, it is a violation of 63.2-1712. That they engaged in placing the child for adoption.
That's your argument?
It is. As indicated, this process began with what we've alleged to be inappropriate conduct by the hospital staff and the doctor by engaging in the practice, the conduct of placing the child for adoption. It was the conduct was further exacerbated by the counsel for the prospective adoptive parents, who, knowing that this was in fact an adoption procedure, nevertheless failed to inform the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court that this was an adoption. Under the law of Virginia, consent cannot be obtained within 3 days of the birth of the child. The consent in this case occurred within 3 days. It occurred during when I say use the term consent, I don't mean to imply that it is a valid consent. I believe the document that was obtained is in clear violation of the law of Virginia. The procedural safeguards that are found in these statutory sections are intended to be the criteria in order to ensure that a birth mother's constitutional rights are not violated. We've outlined the violations of those statutes in our amended complaint, and we've gone in great detail to allege that the individual defendants in this case violated these statutory mechanisms from the beginning on the birth of January 19th.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but the agreed order that the attorney eventually gave to the JNDR judge was not an adoption order. It was a custody order, a temporary custody order.
Well, that's part of what we claim to be so inappropriate about this. The attorney that was handling this case knew that this was an adoption, and yet instead of proceeding under the adoption statute, she chose to do a different statute, which also was violated in this case. The removal of the child using the attorney to do so violated whichever statute you wish to look at this under. Was violated. The statutory mechanisms found in the adoption process is 63.2-1233, and it requires certain procedural safeguards to ensure that a parent's constitutional rights are not violated. None of that occurred in this case. If you use the mechanism that the attorney used to circumvent the adoption process, those safeguards were not followed. And we've indicated in great detail all the safety procedures that are in place to ensure the constitutional rights of Ms. Coward were violated by using that process. So, but for the actions of Ms. Baker disguising this order that she presented and not informing the court that this was actually an adoption, she has facilitated the removal of the child of Ms. Coward in violation of her constitutional rights.
Well, private parties don't violate constitutional rights. State action is a predicate for violations of constitutional rights. But throughout your argument, you appear to be making basically a 1983 case against private parties.
Well, I believe the Wyatt decision indicates that the there is a fundamental rights involved when third parties interfere with a parent's custodial and parental rights. And if I'm using the wrong label there, I don't mean to imply that this is a 1983 claim requiring state action. But this court has created a constitutional tort. That's, I think, the phraseology that has been used from the White case. And what I'm trying to say is that
how can a private party violate the United States Constitution if we're not talking about the 13th Amendment?
I'm not following you.
A constitutional tort, like a Bivens claim or a 1983 claim, is always against a private party unless you have the one exception in the Constitution for private action, which is the 13th Amendment. So It's true Wyatt has a background paragraph that talks about Troxell and repeats some of that soaring language about parent-child relationships, but that does not make this a constitutional tort. It's still a tort against private parties brought by private parties.
Well, I'm not trying to create confusion with my use of the phrase constitutional tort. It's a tortious interference with parental rights that I view to be based upon some fundamental rights that every parent has. And if I've couched it with the use of the phrase constitutional, if that's somehow inappropriate, then I stand corrected.
Fair enough.
My point, I guess, with the statutory scheme that has been cited in the first amended complaint illustrates the egregious nature, we believe, of the attorney that was involved in removal of this child from the mother by, as alleged, has misled the court, and various reasons we allege that the court was misled are contained in the amended complaint. The actions of the attorney in preparing that, despite the actions of Ms. Coward in going forward very promptly after the court entered the order to have all that undone, further exacerbated this interference with Ms. Coward's parental custodial rights.
May I ask you this question? On paragraph 82 of the amended complaint, it mentions that your client advised she didn't want to proceed with the adoption. Was there any manifestation of your client's opposition prior to that? And because this is all, you know, we turn our kids over to others all the time, you know, to the doctor to do something, to the daycare providers, to the school teachers, to grandparents, neighbors, you name it. So we're, you know, parting with the custody of our kids for shorter or longer periods of time all the time. So, but the question is, that has to be against the consent. So if the school teacher just takes the kid and leaves with them and leaves the state, or the doctor just abducts the child, well, that's the problem. So really, consent seems to be the key. And I was just trying to figure out the sequencing of this, where according to the complaint itself, originally she, admittedly under the influence of medication, but it intimates she's open to adoption. And then, you know, at some point, obviously, she's retaining a lawyer, she's objecting, and so on. So the sequencing seems to be key to me anyway. And so when was the earliest point under the complaint where she made it clear that, no, I'm not amenable to this?
Judge, I can only tell you that the complaint only references that she voiced her objections to the Hunleys on January 29th.
Okay.
She voiced her objections. Sorry, what did you say?
In response to the question, I believe that the only reference in the complaint is, as the court indicated, paragraph 82, that she voiced her objection to the Hunleys in paragraph 82. That's referenced in paragraph 82.
Okay, so on the 21st, when the attorney forms were put together, and the 21st when they were filed with the court, 21st when the court issued the order, it was not an adoption order, it was a temporary custody order, and there was consent given at every stage of custody. She withdrew ultimately the telos of this plan, which was adoption, which she initiated. No one initiated it. She initiated it in delivery room. So what did the attorney, other than arguably not following some procedural codes properly, what did the attorney do knowing that the plaintiff did not consent when the attorney's faced with written and verbal consent for custody? Not adoption, but a custody.
Well, you cannot legally consent within 3 days. It's in the code. You may not legally consent.
To what?
I mean, we can call it consent.
You can't legally consent to what?
To this placement of the child pursuant to this adoption agreement.
Okay,
cannot,
what about
it's illegal to do that.
What about consenting to custody? Because go ahead.
I didn't mean it.
Go ahead.
You can't even do that. The court is required under the statutory scheme To give you a wild example that illustrates my point, what if the mother said, I'm going to give custody to the serial killer that's living down the street. Here you go. And the serial killer goes to court and says, she signed it over to me, and, I get custody. What's required under the law is that when this type of circumstance occurs, there's a mechanism for the court to go through to make sure that all the safeguards for changing custody from a parent to some stranger is done in the best interest of the child. There's a mechanism for the court appointing a guardian ad litem. There's home studies to be done. There's all sorts of safeguards to make sure that what claims to be consent is actually done appropriately. And that was not done in this case. And so whatever way that you want to characterize what occurred, in our way is that Ms. Baker, knowing that this was an adoption, disguised this as something else in order to avoid the procedural safeguards that are in the adoption statute, and she chose to do it another way. That way is flawed because there are safeguards even under that scheme that she failed to follow.
Has he answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
Your time is expired.
Yeah. Yes. Do I have just 1 minute left total? I have no time left.
No left.
Okay.
May it please the court, Jeff Geiger on behalf of Sue Baker. This case is obviously the outpouring of the 2012 decision from this court, and I think reference was made to the strong dissent by Justice McClanahan, and I think Justice Mims as well dissented in the case. We're not here to revisit whether or not the tort should have been recognized in Virginia, but what we, I think, need to understand are the contours of the tort and what we're looking for in a case such as this. I would suggest the cases that were used in establishing that the tort exists in Virginia from outside of Virginia, then North Carolina, Maryland, New Hampshire, Alabama, Florida, Texas, Kentucky, all those cases were egregious situations in which you had a situation in which the child was forcibly or knowingly removed from the custody of a parent without the knowledge of the parent and the inability of the parent to obtain that child by use of due process. This court heavily relied upon the Kessel decision in West Virginia. And in that situation, you had a circumstance in which the attorneys were involved in the case, the birth parents were involved in the case, the birth mother was involved in the case, and there was, in that situation, a custody or an adoption that occurred outside of the country. It occurred in Canada. And it was clear from the very lengthy decision by the West Virginia Supreme Court that there was a great concern that people were going to be flouting the law and using these sort of, in their words, intra-country adoption procedures to abscond with the child outside of the jurisdictional reach of the court and basically to deny due process to the parent. In that case, the father had actually filed an inverse paternity case seeking to establish that he was, in fact, the father prior to the birth of the child, with notice to the attorneys that were involved in the case, and the attorneys basically ignored it. In the case that we had in 2012 with this court, in the Wyatt decision, we again had egregious circumstances in which lawyers were actively involved in the case. Lawyers were urging the client. The lawyer urged the client not to let the birth father know that she was in labor, that the father did not know that the child was born two weeks earlier, and that the mother basically spent the majority of the time outside of the Commonwealth in an effort to avoid the father being able to establish his paternal rights. In this case, we have a situation in which that did not occur. In fact, the very custody order that's at issue in this case is confirmation and affirmation of the parental rights that were at issue. In this case, both the mother and the father consented to a custody determination, albeit temporary, but a custody determination, which physical custody alone was provided to Mr. and Mrs. Hunley.
Counsel, let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
Your opposing counsel points out that in this instance, there are certain statutory safeguards that the General Assembly put in place and that those were flouted. Now, it may be that the tort isn't necessarily coextensive with those statutory protections, but could you address that point? For instance, that you just legally cannot give custody under 3 days, and so on. So to the extent his argument has traction, is that, you know, we need to abide by these statutes, and that may inform our reading of the scope of this tort.
Well, I would suggest that, first of all, the tort itself, based upon common law, not statutory, is part of the genesis of why this tort was established in Virginia, or recognized in Virginia in 2012. I think, more importantly, what we're referring to, this framework, this legislative framework, is in fact one that does not provide for civil liability, and secondly, and importantly, is an adoption framework. What we're dealing with is a custody, and as Justice McAuliffe, as you indicated, we routinely provide custody of our child in the care of third parties as part of our daily practice as parents or as caregivers. So that's not something that's unheard of. So the fact that there is an adoption framework, which is not an issue in this case, despite the fact that adoption is mentioned repeatedly, and in fact there was that ill-termed adoption agreement, which was not drafted by anybody that we're aware of that's a party in this case, including Ms. Baker, who I represent, the reference is only to the custody order. It's just custody. It's not adoption.
There's a continuum of custody. Certainly you drop the child off at the daycare center expecting to pick him or her up at the end of the day. One end of custody, Wyatt perhaps being the other end, and this somewhere being in the middle, where even if you're going to give legal custody of your child to a third party, not the daycare, because you're giving them custody of this child, there is involvement in the statute that calls for involvement by social services and a guardian ad litem, is there not?
There isn't with respect to this particular type of a custody.
There is not?
I'm not aware that that's the case, Your Honor. And I apologize if that's inaccurate. And from what I've reviewed and what I understand, the framework of this particular tort is we're focusing on intentional.
Right. I'm not
addressing
the tort. I'm just addressing for now the parameters of exchanging custody from one person to the other. Generally, you have guardians involved. Generally, social services notified. And those are the things that I'm understanding they are alleging were not done in this particular case.
Well, Justice Powell, what I do know is that the conclusions that they made, the legal conclusions that were set forward in the complaint were just that, legal conclusions. I think it is a fair reading of the complaint to look at the facts, which were that there were multiple consents referenced in about five different paragraphs and two different exhibits in which there were consents by the birth parents, and they were witnessed by third parties, none of whom are defendants in this case. I think it's also important.
But if the consents violate the statute, what about that? I mean, answer that question.
Well, I think it's telling that when this tort was recognized, specifically the idea that there were penal statutes and also the General Assembly's absence of action with respect to this area as a private cause of action, undercut the notion that there should not be a private cause of action. In other words, the restatement should be looked to provide that private cause of action. So as far as a violation of any particular statute, I'm not aware that that's the case. I understand that there is a reference to various statutes in the confines of the complaint, but no factual allegations associated with that, other than that there was some kind of submission of an order to a court which signed that order. That's what I understand to be the case as far as the factual allegations in the complaint.
Can I address with you the same question that the last two questions you've been asked? Under the adoption scheme, you file your petition for adoption and you have interim orders, including an interim order for custody. Well, there was no petition for adoption filed. This was something outside that whole system. This was apparently a standalone consent order signed by all parties with prior consents being verifying that the parties had in fact consented, and no allegation that there was no consent on the 21st. The only allegation is consent was lost on the 29th. But on the 21st and 22nd, when the lawyer was involved, there's no allegation that any of that consent was invalid. The argument now is that somehow legally we're going to deem it invalid, even though factually it was valid. But the statutes that are predicated for that are used as predicates for that argument are adoption statutes. So I'm not following how any of that really works. This is not that. Your order is just a temporary custody order. That's actually something that's sui generis. That's not the way you do adoptions, private or public. So it's before all that.
And if I may, I think the dissent in the Wyatt case specifically referred to unauthorized adoptions as opposed to a generalized intentional tortious interference with parental rights. And I think it's important to look to exactly who are the actors that are being sued in the case, and that includes the attorney. The attorney, for a very short period of time, over several hours on January 21st, the only allegations are that the attorney had an assistant read the custody order and petition, which is attached as Exhibit B to the complaint and is not exactly a lengthy document, that the attorney said, I think you're doing a good thing, and that the attorney, quote-unquote, instructed them to sign it. They then signed the document, and it was walked across the street and entered by the court. Those are not the hallmarks of a situation in which you have an intentional interference of the parental right. And that is, I think, the concern that would come out of a decision that we have in this type of a situation. In defining the contours of this tort, you cannot set forward an absence of guidance to the trial court to say, on demur, we're going to let it go to a jury simply because there's an allegation there's been an interference. There has to be a degree of wrongfulness. And that's what we saw with the Kessel case in West Virginia. That's what we saw with the Wyatt case.
I thought they were alleging more than that, that there was this essentially manipulation of the legal process by omitting certain things from what was provided, not putting the name and address and so on, that was part of the mix of allegations as well.
In the Wyatt decision, that's correct.
No, I mean in this case.
That's not accurate in the sense that the order was signed by the birth parents with their full consent. And I think Justice Kelsey indicated that it was only the objection the 29th. It was not, or the consent was withdrawn on the 29th. It was only the objection that was referenced in paragraph 82 of the complaint in which she said, I would like to have my child back. That was January 29th, 8 days later. So there may, in fact, very well be a certain determination that the birth mother, who does maintain legal custody, decides that there wants to be a redetermination as far as physical custody.
Why couldn't, in theory, the birth mother have said on the 21st, look, let's don't worry about all this order and J&DR court stuff. I'm just telling you, I consent. You can have the child until we figure out what to do. And then a week later, she figures out she doesn't want to go through with it. Okay, then we'll deal with that. But there's no, I don't know of any statute or any common law principle that says you even need an order or need a written agreement. The consent to have temporary physical custody can be simply, it's okay with me, you take care of the child, I'll get my act in order, and we'll reconvene a week from now. Wouldn't that be lawful if that had been the facts of this case?
I would suggest that's accurate.
Well, then how could it be unlawful to do exactly the same thing and have a J&DR judge sign an order saying it?
I'm not aware of why that would be the case, especially since the birth parents maintain legal custody over the child.
They have legal custody, and they obviously have not terminated the parental rights, which is what the adoption statute is trying to preclude, is people striking at parental rights. Go ahead.
Again, if we're going to try to look at the confines of this tort, the case that we have before this court can be used as a point to, elucidate for the trial courts that are reviewing these types of matters in circumstances in which there is consent, in which this case there was consent. You can call it a bright line, you can call it a factor, but in this stage, if there is consent, as acknowledged in the complaint no less than five times and with the two documents, how is it that it does not square up with the second element of the tort, which basically says that whether or not there's been an intentional interference without consent, and if there has been that consent, whether it's oral or written, and this is not a case in which it needs to be made by way of a defense, this is pled by the plaintiff herself, then I think we've obviated any concern that there may be. Now, if in fact there is an allegation that in some manner the attorney, in this case Ms. Baker, subverted the process by providing false information or knowing that there was a lack of capacity, then there may be an issue. But that's not alleged. And I think it's critical to recognize that the attorney in this case is being sued. The attorney is not the one that is representing the birth parents. She represents the Hunleys. And there's no allegation that she did anything but her job, unlike in the Wyatt case, in which the attorney was actively involved in disguising the whereabouts of the father, urging the birth mother to lie on affidavits. That is not present
now,
here.
Am I correct, ma'am, that the facts of this case are that they were heading towards adoption? That was, I think I want to have my child adopted. We're going to give you the name of someone that we think wants to adopt a child. So they were heading towards adoption. This was not just a temporary custody. And if they allege, for example, the allegation that your client intentionally interfered with custodial rights by intentionally filing the case under the disguise of a custody arrangement so as to avoid the consent hearing mandated by the adoption statute, why wouldn't that survive demur?
It wouldn't survive demur because you're basically trying to, I think in the words of the GCS case, camouflage an illegal conclusion to make a factual assertion. And in this circumstance, there is no reference that the adoption ever occurred.
But let me stop you there for a second.
Yes,
because I thought the big problem was, or their assertion is that your client intentionally did not file adoption agreement papers that had been signed and that she had in her office. She purposely didn't file those.
There was no allegation in the complaint that I'm aware of, Justice Goodwin, that would provide that reading of it that I'm aware of. What I do understand is that...
Look at paragraph 119. It says, Sue Baker intentionally interfered with custodial rights and the constitutional rights of Samantha by withholding from the court the adoption agreement executed by the parties on January 21st, 2016, which served the basis for the agreed order.
I'm not aware that there is an adoption agreement that was ever attached. The only adoption agreement that I'm aware of was signed on January 20th, and that was attached as Exhibit A as referencing complaint paragraph 46.
But this is a demur, and they've alleged that there was.
Well, and I would suggest that if you're going to review the demur on complaint paragraph 46 on Exhibit A, it has the adoption agreement that was signed outside of the presence of either the Hunleys.
I'm sorry, tell me where that is.
It's paragraph 46 of the complaint, which is on Joint Appendix page 52.
Okay.
Is this the adoption agreement on page 69 of the Joint Appendix?
Yes, sir.
That's not an adoption agreement.
Exhibit A to the complaint.
That's a custody agreement. It says I assign custody. Does it have the word adoption in it except in the title? It's not an agreement to relinquish parental rights for the purposes of adoption. It simply says, I agree to terminate rights for son, assign custody to the Hunleys.
Yeah, but it also says in the document, pending finalization of documents with the lawyer.
Right.
I mean, to me, it's indicating that they're expecting the adoption, I assume, because that's what's in the title of the thing.
That's what they're thinking, yeah.
All right, has he answered all of your questions? Your time has expired. Call the next case.